Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of True Crime on Easy Street. Here we are, part two of the Golden State Killer. Like Scott said last week, if you can't read, you know, the title of the episode.
Yeah, if you've pulled this up and you didn't read the title, this might be a surprise. Otherwise, it will not be.
Yeah.
Part two.
Okay. You guys ready? I mean, are we just going to dive right
into
this?
No, we're not diving right in just yet. Who we need to introduce ourselves.
Who are we?
I don't know.
I have no idea. My name is Scott Wright. I am a mediocre journalist.
I'm Kelly Turner, and I'm not a doctor.
I'm Katie Givens. I'm not a lawyer.
And this is part two of the Golden State Killer.
What did you guys think about last week? I mean, it was kind of, I mean, that's rough.
It's a wild case. It is one that will kind of, it sticks with you, give you nightmares.
I've been doing this for about 3 weeks now, and you and I spoke earlier today on the phone, and I said, I can't wait for this to be over.
Oh, gosh.
I think you say that about all of them, too, though.
I do. I mean, doesn't any normal person say that about all of them? I mean, after you've...
Well, normal is relative with you.
But. Well, that's true. Thank you, Katie, for pointing that out. But, I mean, after you've dug down deep into these, it just, you know, you just want to go home and take a shower.
Yeah, you want to... leave it behind. And it makes your sympathy for the victims and their families even more because you think they lived this. They can't leave it behind.
This case in particular, because this is a case where this guy wasn't known to anyone. Nobody knew who he was for four decades.
That is terrifying.
Yeah, and we're going to get to that. But so today is part two of the Golden State Killer. This is not Harry Potter. This is not he who will not be named. It was for 42 years, but no more. The three of us will never do a podcast where we do not know the name of the Golden State Killer, Joseph James DeAngelo.
Mm-hmm. That's him.
We said his name over 24 times last week, just so that everyone who listens to this podcast will know.
We also said tiny penis quite a bit last week.
Hold my beer.
I got a few comments on that this past week. All positive, by the way, though.
I'm not sure how those two things correlate, but whatever.
But they did.
since his arrest, a little over 4 years ago, a lot of facts have come to light about Joseph James DeAngelo, the Golden State Killer. Let's hit the highlights.
Okay.
Or the lowlights.
Yeah.
As they were. Joseph James DeAngelo was born on November the 8th, 1945 in the city of Bath, New York. His father was a World War II veteran. He saw action in the Pacific Theater as a member of the Army Air Corps. At the time of his birth, DeAngelo's mother was a waitress. If you're curious about the city of Bath, New York, but not enough to Google it, don't worry, I did it for you. About 11,000 people, and the population is about the same today as it was when he was born in 1945. The little bundle of terror that joined the world named Joseph James DeAngelo. He was their second child, the first son. They already had a daughter. Another sister came along in 1947 and another brother in 49. DeAngelo and his three siblings were all not sexually abused by the dad, but physically abused. According to several accounts. And as the older male, Joseph typically got the worst of it. Listen, we're not trying to excuse the crimes that DeAngelo committed as an adult, but I don't believe, and I'm curious to know what you guys think about this, I don't think people are born to be serial killers, although it is totally inarguable that some people do become serial killers. I mean, Jeffrey Dahmer, maybe. Was born to be a serial killer.
His dad said he always knew there was something up with him.
Right. It just seems to me that traumatic childhoods are something common, fairly, that we talk about when we do this show.
Yes.
And the more infamous murders that we have discussed, it all seems like a common thread. But, I mean, what do you guys think about it?
It is a common thread. I mean, we talked about it with Manson. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about it with some upcoming cases.
You're already working on the next thing that you will stab me in the face if I tell anybody about.
Yes.
But you're working on it.
Yes.
So a similar thread there.
Similar.
Okay. Mm-hmm. FBI profiler John Douglas, we've already talked about him many times, Mindhunter on Netflix. In his 2019 book, The Killer Across the Table, he wrote that he believes people who are born with tendencies toward impulsivity, anger, and or sadistic perversions are more easily pushed by events, people, and circumstances in their lives to choose a path that would lead them to become a serial killer. That sounds, I mean, he's probably one of the smartest guys in the world about serial killers. So I'll take him at his word. But certainly Joseph James DeAngelo was no exception to that basic outline. Mm-hmm. But let's get back to his story. So DeAngelo's father, he stayed in the Air Force, which it was called at the time, after the war ended. And at some point, DeAngelo, the entire family, still together, still a nuclear family, stationed overseas in Germany. And that's when another traumatic experience in Joseph DeAngelo's young life took place. Around 1954, while playing in an abandoned warehouse with his younger sister, Constance, she was 7 at the time, he was 9, DeAngelo saw her attacked and sexually assaulted by 2 men.
Oh my gosh.
At that airbase.
Oh.
He was 9. She was 7. They ran home and they told mom and dad about it, and they told them to keep their mouths shut. I mean, think about it. Rape was a crime of shame in the 50s.
Yes.
And sadly, that had not changed in the 70s when DeAngelo was working around Sacramento County as the East Area Rapist.
Mm-hmm.
Fast forward to 1960, the DeAngelos were back in the U.S. living in California. DeAngelo dropped out of high school in 64, but he got his GED and he joined the U.S. Navy. That same year, DeAngelo's parents got divorced and his father moved to South Korea and started a new family. Listen to this, guys. He named his new children the same names as his existing children.
Nuh-uh.
Perhaps a final slap to the face of his ex-wife.
That's weird.
He started his family over name-wise when he moved to South Korea.
Just wow.
So, yeah, what a dick. DeAngelo spent 3 of those 4 years in the Navy serving on warships patrolling off the coast of Vietnam. And there's even one story that I read from a book written by DeAngelo's brother-in-law, a guy named James Huddle. Hold that thought in your head. And he wrote the book after DeAngelo's arrest in 2018. And Huddle says that DeAngelo lost the tip of his right index finger in a mishap while he was on one of those warships in Vietnam. So if you didn't already have a good reason to wear gloves and not leave fingerprints at your crime scene, that's kind of distinguishing if the end of your finger is gone. So just another reason why everybody says consistently, always did, he never took off his gloves.
Mm.
All of his rapes, the witnesses that we have heard from, never took his gloves off.
Yeah, that is a very distinguishing feature.
So after DeAngelo's service in Vietnam, he was able to apply the skills that he had learned in the Navy. I mean, he was a fix-it man on the ship. I mean, he was the maintenance guy. So he learned a lot, or he had a lot of mechanical jobs, a lot of fix-it work. He also was employed at a business that built these large overhead cranes, like in warehouses, to move heavy objects around. Like we have one over at Weiss Dam. If a turbine breaks, there's a huge crane hanging from the ceiling. He built those. At the time, DeAngelo and James Huddle, they were roommates.
Okay.
Which is eventually how DeAngelo met his wife. The young lady was Huddle's sister. Her name was Sharon Huddle.
Okay.
And now James Huddle that I mentioned in his book, and it's titled Killers Keep Secrets. He said that it was while he was DeAngelo's roommate in 1971 that he learned about DeAngelo's previous engagement to a girl named Bonnie Caldwell.
Okay.
That relationship had not worked out. Huddle did not go into detail in his book about exactly what the details were of how that engagement fell apart. Probably because DeAngelo didn't talk about it, and here's why he didn't. Bonnie broke off the engagement because, among other quirks, DeAngelo had this habit while they were being intimate with each other of interrupting his efforts to get to a conclusion. I'm trying to avoid a bad pun here. Typically, he would leave the room for a time, and then he would come back into the room and start over again. Does that sound familiar? If it doesn't, you have not listened to last week's fucking episode.
That sounds very familiar.
Yeah.
Ugh.
And there were other...
What did he do? Did he go get food?
I'm like guessing he went to the kitchen.
And the rapes and yeah. And did he go ransack his own house? I mean...
At least the kitchen
Throw
part.
Things in the floor? I mean... Yeah.
Steal his own jewelry?
What a weird...
And so she's just kind of hanging out.
Well, Bonnie's excuse after years later was, look, that was my first sexual experience in my life. I didn't know.
She didn't know any better.
That this was weird.
Oh.
And she, I bet when she figured out,
I bet when she figured out that wasn't weird, she was like, holy cow.
Yeah, watch this. So there are other odd quirks that D'Angelo exhibited before Bonnie ended the engagement. He enjoyed frightening her. For example, there were these harrowing motorcycle rides. He would just dart off the highway up and down these steep hills at top speed. He would take her on hunting trips that she did not want to go on. And these hunting trips often included nefarious acts, including hopping fences, trespassing, or killing animals out of season. Sometimes all three of them in the same day, Bonnie said.
Mm.
After D'Angelo tried to force Bonnie to help him cheat on a college exam, and here's a little irony for you guys. The class was abnormal psychology.
Oh, God.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Bonnie finally got up the nerve to break off the engagement. A few weeks later, she's standing in her bedroom about to go to sleep, thinking, at last, finally, thank God I have gotten Joseph James D'Angelo out of my life forever. Instead, she saw him standing in front of her on the other side of her bedroom window with a gun.
Shop Cherokee County first. Before you go out of town or shop online, Scott, visit many retail businesses here in Cherokee County. And you want to know why?
Please tell me.
Okay. They are faithful to support our local schools, our sports teams, our clubs, our community nonprofits, and more. So keeping your money here in the local economy, that's going to support all of that.
Teresa and Joy do a great job in the chamber. Amazon sucks. Shop local.
Absolutely agree.
Local businesses provide jobs for you and your neighbors. So brought to you by the Cherokee County Chamber of Commerce, shop local. I've seen you try to go out of town, Scott, and I'm not going to stand for it anymore.
I don't trust myself to drive out of town.
You better take your tail to the local shops from now on. Do you understand me?
I will do a much better job of shopping locally. Thank you for the Cherokee County Chamber of Commerce being a sponsor of the show and reminding us all to shop local. He barked at her, perhaps through clenched teeth, although that detail is not documented. Mm. Come with me right now. We're going to Reno. We're getting married.
That's such a lovely courtship.
Wow. How do you say no?
Hey, you know what, guys? That always works.
Guess who said no? Bonnie ran. She's still living at home. She ran and got her dad.
Of course she did.
Himself, a gritty, I've seen it all, don't fuck with me, World War II veteran.
Good.
He put Bonnie in the bathroom, locked the door, and said, do not come out until I come and get you.
And she said, yes, sir.
Yes, she did. 2 hours later, Bonnie's dad came back and unlocked the door and said, he's gone. Go to bed. She never knew what he said to James D'Angelo, to Joseph James D'Angelo. She doesn't know how that happened. She doesn't know how it was never discussed in the family, but she never heard that name or saw him again until April the 25th, 2018, when we all heard the name Joseph James D'Angelo and saw his picture when he was in an orange jumpsuit in a wheelchair being wheeled into court, mm-hmm. having been arrested for being identified as the Golden State Killer.
They had a conversation that was man to man. That's what happened.
Yeah.
And that the one man, the father put him in his place because she didn't hear from him again. He was not going
whatever
to bother her again.
Whatever that man did.
Mm-hmm.
Shut him down.
It worked.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If only he had been a police officer.
Gosh, I know.
Yeah. So now, don't forget that Huddle, James Huddle, he didn't know anything about the details of engagement. Know, yeah,
right. He just knew he had an engagement that ended.
So he did not know to tell his sister to stay the fuck away from Joseph James DeAngelo when his sister started dating him a few months later.
Mm-hmm. And obviously none of these other things manifested themselves to this roommate, this huddle man, because he would have never allowed his sister, or he would have said, look, not that he would allow her, but he would have said, you're not, no,
he had
do not
no idea.
Him.
Well, he wouldn't have been living with him himself if he knew.
Yeah. Right. He would have said.
Yeah. He was a perfectly normal person. And D'Angelo's family, his daughters, say the same thing. He was a great dad. There was no inclination that he did this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Douglas says in his book. It's not like a serial killer is wearing a hat that says serial killer across the front.
They're very good.
They fit right into society.
Yeah.
They have these bifurcated lives. They live a normal life to everyone else. And then at night they go do their thing.
And we've talked about this antisocial personality diagnosis where serial killers, all of them are antisocial.
Yeah.
They have antisocial personality disorder. Not everybody with antisocial personality disorder becomes a serial killer,
mm-hmm.
but all serial killers are antisocial but that does not mean that they cannot interact with other people. In fact, it's the opposite.
In a
They're
casual,
quite charming.
Normal way.
They're very charming, pleasant people to be around.
Yeah.
They can turn it on, turn it off.
Yeah. D'Angelo graduated from college in 1972 with a degree in, wait for it, criminal justice.
Yay.
Wow.
Just a few weeks later, a series of cat burglaries began in the area, according to Huddle's book. Okay. And he's living with the guy at the time.
Okay. All right.
So basically, D'Angelo had stopped studying to become a criminal. Now he was going to begin to apply what he had learned. While those cat burglaries were occurring, D'Angelo married Huddle's sister, Sharon, on November the 10th, 1973. He was 27. She was 20. Okay. They were still married, although separated, when he was arrested in 2018.
Wow.
They had three daughters, born in 81, 86, and 89. I'm going to slip those birth dates into the timeline that I'm getting to.
Okay.
Just to see if that might give us some inclination about why things happened the way they did. Maybe some clarification, maybe not. I'm curious to know what you guys think. So D'Angelo gets a job in Exeter, California. That happens in 1973. Not coincidentally, perhaps, the number of cat burglaries in that city increased in intensity.
Oh, there's a correlation there.
One day in March 1973, there were three crimes in one day. Houses ransacked. A lot of the time, the burglaries were preceded by hang-up phone calls.
Mm-hmm.
Once, D'Angelo called a 17-year-old girl and he said this, "I love you. This is your last night to live."
It is so unfathomable to me that he's doing this and has three daughters. I mean, I know they haven't been
born
yet. They haven't been born yet.
Right.
But
yeah, this is 79.
But then he has three daughters.
Yeah. And a perfectly normal childhood for all three of them. One of them is a doctor in the Midwest. One of them has a PhD. Flabbergasted by all of this happening.
Can you imagine?
Blown away.
Can you imagine those poor women that have to deal with this now? Because people, you know, people.
Mm-hmm.
And
people suck.
They can sometimes.
Yeah.
And you know they're going to take it out.
Unless you're a listener of the show, I hate you.
But you know that some people hold it against them.
Sure. Oh, yeah, of course.
That their father was this monster.
Guilt by association.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, and wasn't his wife a lawyer?
Yes. Yeah, she had a family law practice, Sharon Huddle D'Angelo, that she closed down within a week of his arrest.
Bless her. And, I mean, I can totally see that. That's.
But now back to that 17-year-old girl and that phone call.
Oh.
Here's a strange note. That girl lived next door to the same house where 5 years later, the Golden State Killer jumped a fence to flee after shooting and killing Brian and Katie Maggiore.
The people who were walking their dog.
The people who walked their dog and happened to stumble across an unski-masked
Joseph D'Angelo. James D'Angelo. Yeah, you talked about that last week. Yeah.
So he had to kill them. Mm-hmm. And he did.
They had been married, 18 months?
Yes. And just a note, I said last week by mistake that Katie had had her 29th birthday. She'd had her 20th birthday.
20th?
4 days before she died. Brian was 21. Katie was 20. They had just gotten married. Newlyweds. Shot dead in the neighbor's backyard because they saw the Golden State Killer without his ski mask on.
And we think he was coming for that 17-year-old girl? Or staking out the place?
He was staking out the neighborhood. That's what he did. He staked out the neighborhood. He prowled.
Did he end up attacking this girl?
Not that I'm aware of. But maybe he found somebody else in the next window that he looked through.
Something didn't work out or something for that.
Right. Yeah. One last thing about the Maggiore murders. When the FBI announced a renewed effort to capture the Golden State Killer in June 2016, they released a series of sketches provided by eyewitnesses through the years. And people who'd gotten a glimpse of D'Angelo without his ski mask on. And there's this one prolific image, and I think Katie and Kelly, you guys shared it on our Instagram page last week. It's those three police sketches.
Yes.
Right? The one on the left, that is the spitting image of Joseph D'Angelo. It was provided to authorities by a teenager who found himself 10 feet away from D'Angelo, staring directly at him in the seconds after he shot Brian and Katie.
Oh my gosh.
He was running.
How come that guy was able to survive?
He was out of bullets. The guy realized he was on the street and didn't want to be seen again. It was better to just leave and go.
Keep going.
But yeah, I've thought about that too. Why did he not get a bullet between his eyes?
I don't know, but I'm glad he didn't. I mean,
yeah.
And
because it's the image, it's the sketch that you put the two beside, and the one that I shared on Twitter and Facebook this week.
Yeah, we shared it on Instagram too.
Good grief. Mm-hmm. Anybody could have, that's Joseph D'Angelo.
Yeah, if you knew that person.
He was a cop at the time. Somebody knew who the hell he was and did not do anything about it.
It's hard to believe that someone didn't recognize. But I guess when you're just not thinking that, especially
right?
Because at he's time, able to.
Well, at the time, I mean, the whole concept of serial killer was still new.
Well,
relatively speaking,
you're just not thinking that when you're. Yeah. He presents himself as a perfectly typical man.
Yeah. Well, he was a police officer, D'Angelo. For practically this entire time that he was skulking around the neighborhoods as the East Area Rapist, he worked for a couple of different police departments, but then he got fired in August of 1979 from the police force for shoplifting from a hardware store.
What was he shoplifting?
He grabbed a hammer
and
dog repellent. So he wasn't
He
wasn't casually shoplifting. Mm-hmm. He was shoplifting for his other job.
For his extracurricular.
Yeah, pretty much. But now before he lost his badge, D'Angelo was described by the men who worked with him as the cop who always remained serious, obsessive even. He didn't joke around or goof off in his downtime like the other guys. And he was always eating. They had a nickname for him, Junk Food Joey.
He was always eating.
Every time they saw him, he had a drink. He had a tab in his hand. Gotta remember tab.
I remember
Katie
tab.
Katie doesn't, but Kelly does.
Not. I would drink a tab
that was Diet
right
Coke
now.
Coke before it was called Diet Coke.
I'd drink a tab right now.
He'd have a drink in his hand, a canned drink, or a bag of chips, they would always say. So think about this. Always serious. Obsessive, enjoyed snacking at odd times. Mm-hmm. Does any of this sound familiar?
Yes.
Yeah. Back to D'Angelo's firing. The more savvy of the police investigators trying to find the East Area Rapist at the time were all afraid of one thing. that some event would trigger this sadistic asshole to transition into committing the act that he was so obviously, in their eyes, building up to, which was murder.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that losing his job...
Yeah, that's a triggering event.
...was the trigger for Joseph James DeAngelo. So the Auburn Police Department fired DeAngelo the day he was accused of shoplifting. He was convicted in October, mid-October, after a three-day trial. And if you're curious, he got a $100 fine, 6 months of probation, and he lost his job. All of that for stealing less than $20 worth of merchandise.
Yeah, but when you're a cop, you don't need to break the law.
I'm almost thinking he was just going to flash his badge and go, "Hey, man, I'm a cop. Don't arrest me." But for some reason, in that hardware store that day, that did not work out for him. And he was arrested and he lost his job.
Mm-hmm.
So just a few days before the verdict was rendered, on October the 1st, 1979, DeAngelo attacked in Southern California with the intent for the first time to rape and then kill his victims. Mm.
Well, at this point, he's no longer a cop. So he's not going to be in on the discussion anymore. He's not going to know the things that he knows.
Yeah.
So he cannot leave anyone alive to tell the story.
That's it. That's what happens. And that's the decision that he makes. So when he commits that next attack, you guys know what I'm going to say. Same MO, same script, flashlight in the eyes at 2 a.m., ski mask, clenched teeth, shut the fuck up or I will kill you. Bad breath, tiny penis. Mm-hmm. After he tied up his victims and separated them, the woman said she could hear the intruder in the kitchen muttering to himself, perhaps between sips of a beer he had stolen from the kitchen fridge. I'll kill him. I'll kill him.
Like, kind of hyping himself up to do it.
That's exactly right. DeAngelo was finally ready to kill that night, but he didn't get to, because he didn't get the chance. When she heard the word kill, the terrified woman started screaming at the top of her lungs. Imagine that. She somehow got up on her feet, ran out the door, butt-ass naked, screaming for help. The husband, he's in the bedroom with plates on his back. He's like, oh my God, he's killing her. I got to run for it.
Mm-hmm.
He gets out the door somehow. He's in the backyard hiding in the bushes. Every light in the neighborhood goes on.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm.
DeAngelo panics, grabs a 10-speed bicycle that he stashed near the house just in case of an emergency, and starts pedaling to get away.
Think about riding a 10-speed bicycle with no pants on.
Oh God, that's exactly where my mind went to.
You know what?
You just literally squirmed in your seat. Mind.
Yeah, I did. Yikes.
Scott,
everybody's had a bad experience with a 10-speed bicycle at some point. Now, the next door neighbor is an FBI agent.
Uh-uh.
Yes.
Wow.
He runs out of the house like everybody else in the neighborhood. What the hell's going on out
here?
And sees a guy in a ski mask and no pants pedaling for his life on a 10-speed.
I'm sorry.
I know. I know. The good news is nobody died this night.
Mm-hmm.
So he jumps into the car, he grabs the radio, calls it in, and takes off after the guy.
Good.
Well, not good, because once again, DeAngelo is gone in the dark.
I mean, how did he get away?
He found a ditch, tossed the bike, jumped down one of those concrete ravines that passes for a creek in California, the flood zones that they've built so that when the waters come up in the spring, it doesn't flood everyone out. And that's how he prowled around these neighborhoods in a large respect. He used these concrete canals and worked his way through the neighborhoods in the shadows.
Very efficiently, it would seem.
Yeah. And you know, he skulked around these neighborhoods. He
knew prowled. Where he was, yes.
He mm-hmm. didn't just show up and park his car and go, "Hey, I'm going here." He'd been there for 2 weeks scouting out the place.
Right.
That was his MO.
And he's been calling, hanging up. He's possibly...
He knows when you're home and when you're not.
Mm-hmm. And he's possibly been in the house while you aren't there.
Several times. And hidden his ligatures under couch cushions.
And that right there is the most terrifying aspect mm-hmm. to this case, is he would go into these homes and hide rope underneath couch cushions.
Right. We talked about that last week, that one woman.
Who watches him pick up her couch cushion and pull rope out from under it.
Yeah.
That is terrifying.
Terrifying, yeah, absolutely.
That was already there, obviously.
Mm-hmm. That, watching that and seeing that, what he has just done, he's turned your house against you. Yeah. Think about that. Your home, your safe space.
The one place you feel safe.
The place that you know better than anybody else. And there's some rando in your house, and he lifts up your couch cushions, and he's got supplies under there.
Yeah.
Can you imagine?
No, that you had no idea we're there.
Well, like we talked about last week, it's fright.
Yes.
It's, oh, my God. He's been in my house.
He knows
just
my house.
Another level of fright.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
So, Kelly mentioned a minute ago, D'Angelo, you know, a narrow escape, and he's not a cop anymore. He can't stand around the water cooler.
Right.
And listen to the latest in the investigation into the Golden State killer, which at the time was still the East Area Rapist. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know if they're onto him or not. So D'Angelo had to relocate. And that meant he had to stake out his new territories before he could strike again. And we know he liked to prowl around and get the lay of the land like we just discussed. So 2 months go by. The next time D'Angelo snuck into someone's house in the middle of the night in Southern California in December of 1979, he had won the argument with himself that he'd had in the kitchen about whether or not to kill someone. There would be no more leaving witnesses, no more taking chances. So the Post Herald here in Cherokee County is a sponsor of True Crime on Easy Street, and we are conducting a subscription drive. What we want you to do is subscribe to the paper, because in December, when the bowl matchups come out, we're going to put an entry list in the paper, and only subscribers to the Post Herald are eligible to win a $500 first place prize. You pick the most bowl game winners, you get $500.
College football bowl games.
College football bowl games.
All right, so step one, subscribe to the Post Herald.
Call 256-927-4476 to subscribe to the paper for as little as $20 a year, depending on your zip code. If you're right here in town, it's $20.
All right. That sounds wonderful.
So I have to give a shout out to a good friend of mine, a local bartender. She saved my voice this morning. I was shouting at Easy Street Restaurant, Bar, and Performance Hall last night over the band. It was very loud, but very good. Voodoo Slim. And they're coming back in November, right?
Yes.
So if you haven't seen Voodoo Slim, for the love of sweet bearded Jesus, come and see them. They're fantastic, but loud. So I used up my voice last night. Angie Dover helped me out with a couple of shots of Jack Honey. And that's why I am talking to you now in a less raspy voice than I might be otherwise.
How many of those shots did you have, Scott?
You would have to have been there to know. And you were invited and you didn't show up. So
that's true.
Yeah. So by the end of 1979, Joseph D'Angelo had relocated to Southern California.
Okay.
On December the 30th of 79, 44-year-old Dr. Robert Offerman was on a date at his house with 35-year-old Alexandria Manning, a psychologist, a colleague.
Okay.
Remember, there are no more eyewitnesses to D'Angelo's attacks.
Right.
All we know about the crimes I'm going to talk about for the rest of this show are based on police reports and on books that a few of the investigators wrote in the years after they retired.
Okay.
Offerman was found shot 4 times. Once in the front, 3 times in the back. His hands were only partially tied. Cops figured that he got loose at some point during the attack and charged at D'Angelo because his body was found in sort of an odd position on the floor, like he had been in motion when he dropped.
Okay.
Manning, she was on the bed naked with her hands tied behind her back. She had been shot once in the back of the head.
Ugh.
Shoe impressions in the dirt outside their home exactly matched those from the October attack where the assailant escaped on the 10-speed bike.
Okay, so he's not changing his shoes.
One other item police found inside One other item police found outside. What remained of the leftover Christmas turkey the couple had stored in their fridge. It was lying on the ground outside behind the sliding glass door, which is probably where D'Angelo entered the house to begin with. He had killed them, eaten their last meal, and walked away, tossing it onto the ground.
Disgusting.
In February, the cops in the Sacramento area heard about these two attacks and reached out to the folks in the Santa Barbara County Sheriff's Department, but authorities there waved them off. "We do not have a serial killer here," they said. "You guys are barking up the wrong tree." It turned out that Santa Barbara didn't want any sort of publicity about a potential serial killer because former California Governor Ronald Reagan lived on a ranch in Santa Barbara, and he was about to run for president of the United States. County sheriffs don't keep their jobs by pissing off their former governor.
No.
Or their future president.
No, no.
So the Santa Barbara cops said, nothing to see here. Move along. The next attack was 3 months later. Lyman Smith was a 43-year-old attorney. His wife, Charlene, was 33. They were killed in their bed on March the 13th, 1980. They were found 3 days later by Lyman's 12-year-old son from a previous marriage.
Oh, my gosh.
Who had come over to cut the grass. He found the front door open, heard their alarm clock buzzing in the bedroom, and ultimately found his father and stepmother bludgeoned to death.
Oh.
With a fire log taken from their back porch, which was still laying in the bedroom floor, covered in blood. Again, local law enforcement rejected the theory from the folks up north that these crimes were related. In fact, one of Lyman's business associates was the primary suspect for a while and spent over a year in custody before he was ultimately released for lack of evidence.
Oh my goodness.
5 months later, Keith Harrington was a fourth-year medical student. He was 24. His new wife, Patty, was 28. She was a nurse. They lived in Orange County, down between L.A. and San Diego.
Okay.
Keith's father discovered them both dead in their bed on August the 19th, 1980. They were both lying on their stomachs. Their hands had been tied, but the killer had removed the ligatures before he left.
Now he's like being resourceful. He's reusing his...
Or at least removing evidence. Both had been bludgeoned to death. Patty had been sexually assaulted before she was killed. It was February the 6th, 1981, before D'Angelo killed again. That was 6 months later. Manuela Withun, Withun. I hope I'm saying that correctly. Withun. Nobody's correcting me. Let's just stop all of that. It was February the 6th, 1981, before D'Angelo killed again. 6 months later, Manuela Withun was alone at home that night. Her husband was ill. He was in the hospital. He had a virus. He was spending the night in the hospital. Manuela was found in her bed, wrapped in the sleeping bag she often used as a blanket when it was cold at night. Remember, it was February.
Mm-hmm.
She, too, had been bludgeoned to death with a weapon that was never recovered. 5 more months pass before Greg Sanchez and Sherry Domingo were found dead in their bedroom in Santa Barbara County. Greg was 27. He was found nude on the floor, partially laying inside the bedroom closet. He had been shot once, not fatally, which led the cops to believe that he deflected a gunshot wound, fought for his life. Ultimately, he died from 24 blunt force trauma wounds to his head.
Oh my goodness.
The killer had removed clothes from the closet and placed them over Greg's head as he laid partially in the closet. Again, no evidence that he had been bound, so I think what happened is that he saw that flashlight in his eyes and he knew he was in a dark room with a cold-blooded killer, and he tried to fight for his life and he died fighting. It was fight or flight and he died fighting. Sherry was 35. She was lying on the bed with her hands tied behind her body. One blunt force wound to the head killed her. A police canvas of the neighborhood after the crime indicated that increased prowling activity had been noticed by several of the neighbors, none of whom had called to report it, perhaps because they didn't realize what they were seeing, because the cops were keeping a lid on the situation, because they didn't want Ronald Reagan screaming in their ear about the existence of a serial killer in his hometown.
But has that ever been actually confirmed? Or
I think the facts.
It was confirmed.
I think I just confirmed it.
Yeah.
If it hasn't been otherwise. I mean, really? You want to piss off Ronald Reagan?
But like a serial killer, how's that? I don't know.
That's how the police departments did not work.
They did not communicate.
Not together and their thought process was, and Larry Crompton says this in his book that I've read, he wrote a great book about this whole series of cases. The cops said that the thinking was, let's don't tell him that we know we're on to him, so he'll keep doing it and we can catch him. I'm not sure if that sound police theory.
And maybe all they had at the time.
But maybe it was all they had. All they had was ballistics and fingerprints. We don't have DNA yet. We will get to that next week.
Hey, guys. This week coming up at Easy Street, we've got Tuesday Night Bingo with Shane, as always.
Ugh, gross.
Wednesday night, Scotty Sam's will be playing at the bar corner. Thursday night is karaoke, as always. Friday night is Jake and Casey. They'll be playing at the bar
Those
corner as well.
Those guys are amazing.
Oh, yeah. They're great.
Yeah.
And Saturday, new band Easy Street, Saints and Rebels will be there. And as always, every day at 4 o'clock, you can come have dinner with us. We're open Tuesday through Saturday.
Oh, I'm going to come have dinner this week.
You say that every week.
And I'm there
and
every
I never
week.
See you there. And I'm there all the time.
It's because you're drunk.
And you don't eat dinner.
Fair enough. That happened in September of 1981. Turns out D'Angelo was done for a while. I mean, if you think about it, he did have a new daughter to help take care of because she had been born in September of 81, just 6 weeks after Greg and Sherry were killed. That was daughter number one for the D'Angelo family.
So that's what they're saying were the reasons for the gaps in
Maybe
attacks.
It explains, because that happened in 81 and D'Angelo doesn't strike again until May the 4th of 1986, 4 years, 9 months, and 8 days after Greg and Sherry died, 18-year-old Janelle Cruz was home alone when Joseph D'Angelo snuck into her house and, based on the evidence at the scene, dragged her from the kitchen to the bedroom. There was blood between the two locations. Once there, he bludgeoned her in the face so badly that she had to be identified with dental records.
Oh, my gosh.
Janelle Cruz was D'Angelo's last known victim, and that was in 86, like we said. And it was just about that same time that police labs were beginning to learn about the use of DNA to solve cold cases and identify criminals, especially sexual predators that left evidence behind. And remember, we've already said this, D'Angelo wasn't a cop anymore. At this point, he's a mechanic at a grocery store distribution center, and he worked there from 79 until he retired in 2016. But even though he wasn't a cop, he had that criminal justice degree, so maybe he's keeping up with the literature. He's got a subscription to a couple of magazines. He's learning about what the criminal justice system is learning about DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. And maybe he was smart enough to realize that his MO wasn't foolproof anymore.
Yeah, because, I mean, it does not matter the size of your penis. You're going to leave DNA.
Right. Yeah.
So he has to know that that's not going to work anymore. And when you're bludgeoning people, I mean,
it's quieter.
This is, well,
he stopped shooting and he started bludgeoning because it's quieter.
It is quieter, but and I'm sorry about this. It's messier.
Sure.
And you run the risk of getting injured in the process and leaving.
And getting evidence blood on you.
And, or getting evidence on you. Yeah. Things like that.
Yeah. Whatever the reason, the Golden State Killer retired in 1986.
How many daughters does he have at this time in 86?
You're one sentence ahead of me.
But oh, I'm sorry.
That's fine. And perhaps it was because he was expecting his second daughter. She was born in November of 86. So his wife was 3 months pregnant when Janelle Cruz was killed. D'Angelo's third daughter came along in 1989. At the time of his arrest, members of D'Angelo's family all expressed shock and disbelief that the man they knew could be guilty of such heinous acts. All three daughters called him a good dad. They all lived normal lives. One is a doctor. I mentioned that earlier, out in the Midwest. Another working on her PhD. She probably has that by now. I'll bet by a different last name. D'Angelo's ex-wife, Sharon, she's an ex-wife now. She divorced him after he was arrested. She said she never suspected a thing. She said that when he told her he was going on hunting trips or working late or going to visit his parents who live several hours away, she took him at his word and never questioned the reasons why he was gone for days at a time.
Did she ever report any of this behavior that Bonnie reported?
I don't know about any of that.
The trying to frighten her, the, you know, all of those things.
Not necessarily the
sexual behavior, but the prone to violence or outbursts and things like that.
I'm not sure anything Sharon Huddle D'Angelo could say would satisfy anyone.
Yeah, I was just wondering.
I know what you mean.
Was totally able she to just cut those, that off with her and she, then go another direction, or
what she said that I just recounted. She said in an impact statement to the court after he was arrested. Okay. So just to kind of explain, hey, don't look at me.
Right, right. Yeah.
So she closed down her family law practice within a week of her husband being positively identified as the Golden State Killer. And next week in part three, we will tell you how that happened.
Oh my gosh, Scott, what a cliffhanger. How dare you for the second week in a row?
Yeah, we've hung them again.
Oh, well.
Thank you so much. Very interesting. I learned a lot today. Like I said, I know about this case, but I'm learning.
You should listen to this podcast more often. You would learn even more.
I should. I really should. Thank you for that. You did an excellent job. I can't wait until next week when I get to hear from both you and Katie on how this guy
was caught. An Alabama tie-in next week. Katie has a surprise next
week. How about that? Yeah. That's awesome. All right. Well, thank you so much for listening to us. Please visit our website, truecrimeoneasystreet.com, for all of the information on us, on merch, on our social media. You can follow us on those. And we share some photos and things that we talk about.
Do we do that? Here.
We do on Instagram. I don't know what you do on Facebook, but I do that on Instagram.
Okay, fair enough.
And Katie does that on Instagram as well.
I'm not sure she does anything. Yeah. She's wearing the hell out of that hat, though.
She does help me with Instagram, absolutely. So follow us on social media, and don't forget to subscribe and rate. Give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcast and comment so we know it's you. Yeah, Shorty, a.k.a. Dance and Trav. A.K.A. Travis. I saw that beautiful comment you just recently posted. Thank you so much. Yes, we love Shorty. Yeah, Shorty, you know what? We're a fan of you. How about that?
That is so true.
So true. Yep. Good night, everybody.